I'll be reading from 1 John chapter 5, verse 4. For whatever is born of God overcomes the world, and this is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith.
Good morning. No tornado sirens today. We are blessed with a good opportunity to worship together. Glad that you're here. We have a number of people traveling today, and we have some visitors, and we're just thankful to see all of you. A number of weeks ago, I had some real struggle in my heart. Had some things going on in my family back in Oklahoma that just grieved my heart greatly. And I was so grieved, I stayed up one whole night just thinking and worrying and concerned, you know, how we get with those type of things. And the next day, I came to my office and I just sat down and I said, okay, I'm going to read the book of Job. So I read the book of Job several times since then. And I've decided to share with you a very short series of sermon from the book of Job, and I've titled the sermon series, Faith Under Fire. Hence all the good songs that we sang this morning that Brother Jay picked out in regard to faith. So we're going to have a few sermons from the book of Job. Before we get started, I want to tell you a story. I hope this is true. I got it off the internet. Surely it's got to be true, right? About this photographer who worked for a national magazine, and there was this big forest fire, so they sent the photographer to the forest fire to get a picture, you know, for their publication. And when he got there, he couldn't see a thing because there was so much smoke that he couldn't get a shot or nothing. So he called back to headquarters and he said, look, I cannot get a picture of the fire because there's just too much smoke and stuff. And they said, okay, well, I want you to go to the local airport and we're going to hire a guy to fly you up and over the fire so you can take a picture of it. Go meet him at the airport. He'll be setting out on the runway with the engine running, waiting for you. So the photographer went to the airport and he got out of the car, and there's, sure enough, the airplane sitting out there on the runway, the motor's on, you know, running, and he runs out there with his duffel bags and everything, and he jumps in, and he says, okay, he says, let's go. And sure enough, the pilot turned the plane into the wind and took off. Once they were airborne, the photographer said, now here's what I expect from you. I want you to make a few low-level passes over the northern end of the fire so I can take pictures. And the pilot said, what? And he said, I take pictures, you know, that's what I do. I'm a photographer. I need you to make some low-level flights over the north end of the fire. And the pilot said, I thought you were the instructor. Troubles come in many different shapes and sizes. And we've all experienced struggles in many different ways. As I thought about my own struggles, I spent some time in the last few weeks thinking about some of your struggles too. Struggles with sickness, struggles with health, surgeries, struggles with the death of a loved one. Some of our members struggle with loneliness. Some of our members haven't found that mate that they want to marry yet. Some folks struggle with money. Some of us struggle with family issues. Some of our number are struggling with job problems. Even a lack of job for some of us. Some of us have marriage problems. Some of us just have flat tires on occasion with no jack. then there is the struggle with sin. Sometimes struggling leaves us wondering where God is. Today I want to share with you the story of a man who struggled through life, but instead of that struggle leading him away from God, that struggle, that turmoil in his heart led him to a closer relationship with God. There's a question that I would like for you to keep in mind as we go through this entire series, and particularly the sermon this morning. The question is how will you respond when tragedy strikes your life? Now, I want you to look at that sentence I just said. How will you respond when tragedy strikes your life? It's not if, folks. It's when, right? I want to begin in Job chapter 1. So if you have your Bibles and like to turn there. Job chapter 1. It's on page 731. Job chapter 1. I'd like to begin by talking a little bit about verses 1 through 5. And I want to do this in a way that I introduce to you the man Job and who he was. First of all, in verse 1, when we take off, we understand just the name Job itself. Hebrew names always had a meaning behind them, and so did the name Job. There are possibilities. The book of Job, I've heard so many people talk about how easy it is, and when I read it, it's hard for me. And I turned over in one of the commentators and read what he said, and he said, this is the hardest book of the Bible. And I thought, good, I'm in good company. Some of it is because some of the translation of the words are hard to understand. Now, the name Job has several different possibilities. Here are some of them. To be an enemy. To be an opponent of God. Or one that God has treated as an enemy. Or one who repents. When you look at those things, you can see some of them may be included in the whole book, but the most accepted definition, and the one I'm going to latch on to this morning, the most likely, is the definition Job means, where is my Father? Where is God? So Job, just by definition, is going to go through some struggles in his life. Now, God begins Job by an introduction of just who Job is. And God says, look, there are four things that Job is, and he identifies his character in this way. Number one, he says, Job is blameless. That is, he is a whole man. He is complete. This is not a guy who goes through life on every wind and wave and every up and down, but this guy has reached a level of spiritual maturity, a completeness in the Lord. He's blameless. Number two, God says, Job is upright. That is, he does not deviate from God's standards. Here's a man who does not look to his own design and his own plan and his own objective. He doesn't consider his own way, but he recognizes that God is the standard in his life, and he does not deviate from that. Number three, God says that Job is that he fears God. The words in the Hebrew here help us to understand that what he's talking about is a reverence to God, a care for what God is, a humble submission in the presence of the Almighty, an understanding that I am here and He is here. He is great and I am nothing. That's how Job looked at God, in a reverent submission, humble submission to His will. And number four, God says of Job's character that Job turned aside from evil. That is, Job actively chose to avoid sinful situations in his life. Not just going through life in one of these I'll just take it as it comes thing. But he thought about things in advance. I'm not going to go on this side of town over here because I might be tempted to sin. Or you know what, I'm going to make a covenant with my eyes not to look at a woman in such a way that it could cause me to lust. Job was serious about avoiding sin. Now how would you like to have God describe you in that way? I'd sign up for that program, wouldn't you? I'd want for God to say that of me. As a result of the way that Job lived, God certainly blessed him. Number one, Job had a lot of children. He had 10 children. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. Now, I'm telling you, that's a blessing. I want you to just look around the auditorium now. We have all these little children. Isn't this a blessing? It is a wonderful blessing. It's the same for any family. A family that has... I have 3 sons and I am so blessed. Man, if I had 10... I don't know what I'd do, to tell you the truth, but it'd be fun, whatever it was, right? Engel's laughing back there, okay. So he was blessed with children, and he was also blessed with great wealth. The guy had, verses 2 through 3, he had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 oxen, 500 female donkeys. Now why? Would we want to emphasize that it's a female donkeys? If you have female donkeys, you have the ability to reproduce a herd. That's a money-making deal right there. That's why people raise cows. Same principle. All that points toward his wealth. He also had servants. And another thing that Job had was great prominence. It says that he was greater than all the men of the East. Job, you see, had a social standing. Job had the respect of the society in which he lived. Church, Job was on top of the world. Job had everything going for him. You know, there's another thing interesting about Job. Job also, verses 4 through 5, he took it upon himself to look out for the spiritual needs of his family. The text tells us that his kids would get together on their day. Commentators think that that is their birthday. I have no reason to object. Whatever their day is, they would get together and have some party time. And that party time involves some drinking. And Job, when the drinking was done, would consecrate them in an effort to dedicate them to the Lord and to ask the Lord forgiveness in case they had committed any sin in this drunken stupor. He was ministering to his kids. Now I want to point out to you, his kids have grown and moved out of his house. When your kids grow up, church, you don't have the right to abandon them. They're still your responsibility. You men are still the spiritual heads of your family. And I'm talking to myself. Well, someday when my kids get grown up, I'm certainly going to try to follow the example of Job here. Job was you might think of him as a priest for his family. Okay? It's no wonder in verse 8 that God says of Job that there was no one like him on the earth. There is no one like him on the whole earth. So that is Job. Now let's begin the story, having introduced him to you. Verses 6 through 12. Satan comes to God and makes the greatest allegation against God that has ever been made. Satan comes and accuses God of the greatest of all sins, and this is what he does. God's having a meeting with his angels, and Satan shows up. And in verse 7, God turns to Satan and he says, "Where have you been?" And Satan says, oh, I've been out roaming and walking on the earth. When you turn over to 1 Peter 5 and verse 8, you understand a little bit of what's going on there. 1 Peter 5, 8 says, your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. So when God is asking Satan, where you been, what you been up to, he says, look, I've been prowling around on the earth. I'm looking for some souls to steal. I'm looking for some people to corrupt. I'm trying to take some people down. That's what he's doing. So God says this. He says, have you considered my servant Job? Now, I don't know about you, but if God is going to have a chat with Satan, I would just assume him to leave my name out of the equation, wouldn't you? But here, God is simply putting forth his best man. And he says, why don't you take a shot at Job? Our human fear is that God is needlessly putting Job in danger, but church, that is not what's going on at all. God is using Job to set a trap for Satan. But to this, Satan says this basically. Well, God, you just don't play fair. Now, don't look in your text. That's not there. You're going to have to read a few things to get that. But I'm telling you, in short, this is what he's going to say. God, you don't play fair. Have you ever played that, played games with the little kids, and then you say, well, you're not playing, you're cheating, or you know all this stuff. Sometimes when I was a kid, it was because I was cheating. My sister said that to me. But, you know, you ever say that? Well, it's just not fair. Satan says, you know what? This isn't fair. He basically tells God, listen to this. You really need to get a hold of this, or you're going to miss the whole point of the book of Job. He basically tells God the only reason that men love you is for what they get out of the deal. The only reason, Satan is saying, God, listen here, the only reason people love you is for what they get out of it. Men don't love you for who you are, but men love you for what you do for them. And that's what Job is doing. He's loving you only because you bless the hound dog out of him. You take away those blessings, Satan says, and he will curse you to your face. I think it's interesting here that God applies the principle of Proverbs 26 and verse 4, don't answer a fool according to his folly. God merely gives Satan the power to make a fool out of himself. He allows Satan to test his theory with the only restriction that he not be allowed to lay a hand upon Job. And before we leave this thinking, I'd like to point out that Satan has an M.O., a modus operandi, a usual way of doing things. And you know what that is? Satan always likes to blend a little bit of the truth with a lie. That's how he likes to attack things. He did it in the Garden of Eden right from the beginning, and he's still doing it today. The true part of what Satan said was that many people do embrace God for what they can get out of the deal. Hence, an enormous movement in our own brotherhood to make worship about us, and worship about how we feel, and worship about what we can take home instead of worship being about God Almighty. I think each one of us should ask ourselves today, what is the motivation behind our love for God? I want you to take this next sentence home with you, okay? I want to ask you a question. It's going to set the stage for how you understand the entire book of Job. If there was not the promise of heaven, if God never promised you heaven, would you still serve Him? Church, what I'm saying is, if there was nothing for you to gain, would you still want to bow down in the presence of God and glorify His name? If there was nothing you could get, would you still love Him? I hope so. Because that is exactly what God calls us to. So verses 13 through 20, Satan sets out to prove his point. Satan takes away all that Job has in the matter of a few minutes. And I make that assumption based on if you read the text closely, you find out that things are linked so closely. It happens in bullet fire, rapid fire succession. In a matter of moments, Job loses everything he has. Job, on one of these feast days, when his kids are over here partying and getting drunk and celebrating, on that kind of day, a messenger comes to Job, and he says, the Sabaeans have attacked. They've taken the oxen and the donkeys, and they've killed all of your attending servants. Only I have escaped. And while he was still speaking, the second messenger comes. Not great time is passing. The second messenger comes in. He says, fire from heaven has fallen. Lightning, who knows what. Some kind of fire from heaven. It's burned up your sheep and the attending servants. Only I have escaped. And while he was still speaking, the third messenger comes. The third messenger says, hey, the Chaldeans have raided. They've taken your camels. They killed your attending servants, and only I have escaped. And while he was still talking, the fourth messenger comes in, the messenger that you don't ever want to come to your home. The messenger comes to the door and says, Job, a great wind has brought down the house that your children were in, and they have all died. There are surely folks in here who have lost a child. And that's got to be the roughest thing in the world. Job had lost everything that he had. He lost his wealth. He lost his servants. He lost his prominence, and he even lost what was most precious to him. He lost his children. And I just pause here to wonder why God would allow His servant to suffer in such a way. Is it okay to ask that question? I think so. Here's what I know for sure. Enduring suffering builds character, and that completes us. James chapter 1, verse 3 through 4. And holding fast is also understood as a process of refinement in Isaiah 48 and verse 10. God can and will allow difficult situations to happen in our lives. But He doesn't forget us. And in regard to that, chapter 1 and verse 20 says that Job tore his robe and shaved his head. And if with a little bit of study, you understand that that is the grieving process. Job is grieved to the core of his soul. His heart is broken. He stands there rendered before God. He is in great turmoil in his spirit, as would any of us be in similar circumstances. But here's the good news. Now in our text, we get to see how a godly man responds to tragedy in his life. this godly man is going to take a different kind of approach during a struggle in his life. You know, I like the old proverb, and I've said it a time or two, that people are like tea bags. You never know what they're made of till you put them in hot water. I find that to be true. If ever, church, there's a time for focus, it is in the face of adversity. If ever there's a time to keep your chin pointed to heaven, it's when your heart is hurting, when the things going on around you are weighing in on you. But many times, people are reactionaries. Moved by the moment, oftentimes people speak without thinking. They act without forethought. And they end up lashing out at God and the world. Some people, in the face of such agony, close themselves off to the world. They build brick walls around them to get behind and hide behind. They let anger fill their soul and bitterness move their thinking. But church, Job, a righteous man, was not moved by circumstance. And nor should we be. Here's what this man did. In the face of losing his dignity and his honor, his wealth, his kids, and crushed with grief, here is what this man did. This man fell to the ground and worshiped God. Now, I want you to really think about that. Put yourself in Job's position. A messenger has just come to you and told you that your children have died. All of your goods in this world have been carried away. Man, you talk about a bad time. You talk about a time to say, why me? Where are you, God? What a time to say, this isn't fair. But Job didn't do that. Job got down on his knees and he praised God. He got down on his knees and he worshiped God Almighty. The question is how will you respond when tragedy strikes you? Job said this, verse 21, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. Job understood that everything he had, all of it belonged to God. He also recognized that God had allowed his blessings to be removed. He says this, the Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. He doesn't think that God was asleep at his post. He doesn't think that somehow God's not mindful of him. He doesn't think that God doesn't care about him. But he understands, just quite frankly, that God has allowed it to happen. He knows that nothing can happen without God saying it can happen. And with this statement, he makes this proclamation, blessed be the name of the Lord. There's your answer to tragedy. And in all this, verse 22, Job did not sin, and Job did not blame God. In your struggles, have you gotten on the wrong airplane? Who's the pilot on your airplane? I thought about what Paul told the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 7, that we walk by faith and not by sight. You know, it's easy to quote that little passage because it's just real short and we've said it so many thousands of times, but do we believe it? Do we believe that our walk, do we walk that away? Do we walk by trusting in God and not by the things that we see? You know what, church? I want to tell you something. Sometimes you need to close your physical eyes so you can open your spiritual eyes and walk by faith, not by sight. And if we will have any victory in this life, it will be because we have put our faith in the right place. 1 John chapter 5 and verse 4. With that, I want to ask you if you have a struggle in your life that you need to share with the church. Do you have a struggle in life that you've not been acting in a righteous way about? Has your struggle consumed you? In your struggle, have you thrown a pity party for yourself? In your struggle, have you said this is not fair and lashed out at people around you? Or in your struggle, have you attempted to try to justify yourself instead of justifying God? If you have a need this morning, I'd like to invite you to come as we stand and sing.